This is the takeaway for Friday, August 18th, 2017. This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. We're happy to have you with us on this Friday. Yesterday, the world was rocked by another terrorist attack. We'll have details from Barcelona in just a few minutes. But first, we have news out of Washington today. President Trump has told senior aides that he's decided to remove top strategist Steve Bannon. The Democrats, he told The Prospect, the longer they talk about identity politics, I got them. I want them to talk about racism every day. If the left is focused on race and identity and we go with economic nationalism, we can crush Democrats.
I think he believes that this is a this argument is a political benefit to Donald Trump and to conservatives and Republicans in general.
That's Susan Page, Washington bureau chief for USA Today. She says the president's reactions since Charlottesville are less failures of the moment and more Steve Bannon's long-term strategy.
There is some history that racial politics can benefit conservatives and those who stand against kind of arguments for diversity. The nation is changing in terms of becoming more diverse and becoming more tolerant of diversity. But the election last November, I think, was a sign that old racial politics can still work.
So Steve Bannon may be gone from the White House, but even as he exits, it's a strategy the president is already employing. This week, President Trump has tweeted about tearing down Confederate monuments and memorials, street signs and markers all across the country. It's an old political story that's taken on new intensity now, with a president who feels he has something to gain by not isolating white supremacists. The divisions here are real. The president's strategy is real, too. So what does that mean for us? Sean King is a columnist with the New York Daily News and a social justice activist, and he joins me now in the studio. Sean, thanks for being here.
Hey, man. Good to see you.
A minute ago, I saw you, and I said, how you doing? And it wasn't as simple an answer as probably we're used to giving.
Right. You know, already when we ask and answer those questions, we're not always being truthful anyway.
Yeah, you say, yeah, I'm good.
Yeah, I'm good. Even if you're not, even if you just had an argument with your spouse or loved one or whatever, you don't say that. But now when people ask you how you're doing, like even me coming into the building, several different people ask me or I ask them, and everybody pauses because we're not okay. And I'm not okay. You're not okay. And the struggle is it's difficult to articulate precisely what's wrong because so much is wrong. And so no, I'm not fine like I normally am. It'd be a lie to say so. But it is hard to put words on exactly what's wrong because so many things seem off.
That suggests though that there's something really new about this past week, right? But racism isn't new. White supremacy isn't new. Even the president's inability or unwillingness to advance the country morally isn't new. But there's something about the last week that seems unprecedented. I think that's what you're getting at.
Yeah, you know, I agree with that assessment. And that's what I hear. Like, I see a lot of people saying that same thing. Like, listen, racism has always been here. So why are we responding this way now? But this past week has been groundbreaking in a few different ways. Like the sheer volume of what happened in Charlottesville is new. That number of white supremacists and neo-Nazis assembled in that way is new. Also, there's a new face to it for most of us. There's a stereotype of a white supremacist that looks one way, and we're seeing it now in a very different form. And I think it's disarming for people to see it in a way that looks unfamiliar. It is no longer a Southern tattooed redneck, but it looks like somebody in khakis and polos with a clean cut. So that kind of took the rug out of what white supremacists look like for a lot of Americans. And then it was violent. And we had someone killed and people injured. And people just felt like, okay, somebody of note needs to stop this, needs to intervene. And instead, the president of the United States was completely silent for days and then ultimately kind of co-signed and endorsed the white supremacists and neo-Nazis, defended them in some ways. And for me, that's new. Like, I don't think in my lifetime I've ever seen a president defend neo-Nazis the way Trump did this past week. And that was painful to experience. And it, again, there was a safety net for the past 8 years with President Obama. Like, there were times where we hoped he would do something. He didn't always do it, but he would at least always say something. And here with Trump, anytime he would open his mouth, he would often make matters much worse.
I mean, that's the part that's new, right, is the cover.
Yeah.
That those guys marching in Charlottesville and others felt like they had from the president. I mean, there was a Klan rally 30 miles from my house in Pennsylvania when I was a kid.
Right.
But the protection, in a way, the cover that these marchers felt like they had from the very top was something I have never, ever seen before. Never imagined, really.
No, I never imagined it either. And the same thing, I grew up in rural Kentucky, and, you know, as a teenager, I moved to Georgia. We always saw these types of things on the news. But they were kind of universally panned as being the fringe of America, as being the worst of America. Like, this is the exception to the rule. And by and large, people on both sides of the aisle, people from all walks of life, saw it and were disgusted. But it was clear that not only was the president feeling it very differently about it, but the white supremacists there in Charlottesville and around the country were watching Donald Trump very closely and felt the same way we felt. They felt like, wow, he is defending us. And so I've been studying message boards and white supremacist sites for all this week, and they've seen this past week as an enormous victory, in huge part because they feel like they got what they wanted from Donald Trump. Like, one of the phrases I see them saying all the time is, he's back. Like, he is now back to being who we thought he would be for us. And in a sense, I believe that. I agree with them. To have the president of the United States, whether it's Donald Trump, regardless of what we think about him, but to have someone in that office, in that position, defend them and defend what they're fighting for has given them a level of legitimacy that I'm not even sure they thought they were going to get.
Still, Sean King, you heard Susan Page at the top there, Steve Bannon's interviews that he's given over the last couple of days as Confederate monuments come down in reaction to this. Bannon says, great, identity politics will win. Bring those monuments down. Make it about identity politics. The president is picking that fight, seems to agree with Bannon, got on Twitter yesterday and extols the virtues of beautiful Confederate monuments. That part of it, the monument part, identity part, is now strategy.
Yeah, and we should have seen this coming. As soon as Trump's approval ratings started to tank, my prediction was he is going to do anything and everything to sew up his base. And that's exactly what we're seeing. Like, as soon as his approval ratings started getting in the 30s, there was a part of me that started getting nervous, because I knew he would fight back to make sure that they'd never got lower than that. And so that means going back to, again, what white supremacists say, going back to campaign Trump, where he is fully engaged in identity politics. And I believe he's done that in many different ways over the past 3 weeks, be it attacking transgender people in the military, which was so random, but all about culture and identity politics. This awful thing that he tweeted yesterday, this kind of genocidal tweet about killing Muslims and burying them with pigs. Like, that's not policy. That's not normal. That's about saying inflammatory stuff that will appeal to his base. And it's deeply disturbing. But I think we are getting a glimpse of, this is Trump with his back against the wall. And it's worked in this sense. Nobody's talking about Russia. Nobody's talking about healthcare. We are now all stressed and confused and worried about America in a way that we weren't just 2 or 3 weeks ago. And now we are all focused on very different things that he has thrown out there. This is what we thought having Steve Bannon as your chief strategist would look like. This is a Breitbart presidency.
And yet, there have been reactions from around politics. Some of them have been surprising. This is Senator Bob Corker, the Republican chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, just yesterday. Listen to this.
He also recently has not demonstrated that he understands the character of this nation. he has not demonstrated that he understands what has made this nation great and what it is today.
Again, Sean King, that's Republican Senator Bob Corker, chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee and an ally of the president's in public that you just heard.
Yeah. When I hear that, you know, Corker's deeply conservative dude, you know, and when I hear that, a lot of my progressive friends, and I'm as progressive and as liberal as it gets, and when a lot of my progressive friends hear that, they discount it, but like, ah, he's just, it's all talk, it doesn't matter. I don't believe that. Like, that's a change to see a deeply conservative Republican senator call him out like that. Like, if we didn't know who that was, we could have assumed that was the harshest critic of President Trump. And that's, I think, a turning point, at least for someone in his position to be able to call him out in that way. I think it matters.
So, Sean, we're going to let you go. I appreciate you stopping by. We started this conversation by acknowledging that it's been a bewildering and confusing week. What's your hope for next week? I will give you the weekend off, and when you wake up Monday morning, what's your hope for next week, realistically?
Well, yeah, man, that's a more difficult question to answer than I would have thought. You know, normally you can just look forward to a week and wonder. There are probably two things that I'm hopeful for. There were some horrendous neo-Nazis and white supremacists who attacked a young man, DeAndre Harris, in Charlottesville. And I hope by this time next week that some of those men have been held accountable and have been arrested. And I hope that we continue to organize in simple grassroots ways to see how we can begin fighting back. And that may mean local politics. It may mean local marches or protests for wherever you are. But don't just tweet and Facebook, which is fine. Figure out ways that you can get involved locally and make a difference. And I think we're all a little shell-shocked this week. And I think once we process what we've seen and experienced, I think Americans will begin to say, yeah, I want to fight back in some practical ways.
Sean King, columnist with the New York Daily News. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, man.
So many people were out, lots of families, lots of little children. It was great. The weather was beautiful. And then around 5, we decided to head back to the hotel, and we went down a side street, and then all of a sudden we heard lots of people screaming and crying and yelling, and I'm like, well, what's going on here?
I came just to hear, and I was skating down the street with my headphones in, so I wasn't really aware of what was going on. It wasn't until the van started to come to this area just behind me where it was striking people and hit the kiosk that I then heard it, because it was right next to me.
But somebody was screaming, and then everybody started to run because they're screaming from behind, and everybody just ran forward.
On Thursday afternoon, a terrorist attack hit the streets of Barcelona. As pedestrians walked along a popular tourist boulevard called Las Ramblas, a van sped onto the sidewalk, mowing down people in the crowd. So far, at least 14 deaths and more than 100 injuries have been reported. ISIS claimed responsibility for the attack through their news agency, Amaq. Raül Romeva is Minister of Foreign Affairs for the Catalan government, and he says the first priority is attending to the victims and their families.
I have to say that the reaction of the population, but also obviously the police and the institution, has been of a very high quality. So far, this is the main priority. The second priority, of course, is still following up the investigation. As you probably heard, we have some detainees. So far, we have 4 detainees, which means that while the operation is still open, we're still looking for other possible people that could be involved on that attack. And as long as this is open, we cannot be more specific. Once the investigation will be closed, we will make public the results. But so far, these are the 2 priorities that we are focusing on.
It's the latest in a string of vehicle attacks in Europe over the last 2 years, but it's also the first major act of terror in Spain since the 2004 Madrid train bombings. Here with the latest from Barcelona is Fiona Govan. She's editor for The Local in Spain, and she's in Barcelona now. Fiona, welcome.
Thank you.
Describe the area of Las Ramblas where this attack took place, the layout of Las Ramblas, and why pedestrians in this place may have been a target.
Well, anyone who's been to Barcelona will know that it really is the kind of throbbing artery of the city, of the old part of the city. It's in the old town. It's the main thoroughfare. It's a pedestrianized area with bars, tapas bars, restaurants, shops, souvenir stalls. And traditionally, people strolled up and down it under the trees and in the shade at around 5 o'clock in the afternoon, which is exactly when this attack happened yesterday. So you can imagine it's absolutely throbbing with tourists at the moment. It's the busiest week. It was a holiday earlier in the week in Spain, and so many people take their holidays in August. And although the area was pedestrianized, there are areas where cars can go on either side and at the top of the street. So this van mounted the pavement and knew exactly what it was doing in terms of choosing its target. To be honest, it's surprising that they weren't able to kill more people, because from eyewitness reports, the van was weaving from side to side and really, really plowing people down. And it traveled about 200 yards from the road. So 13 people were killed in that spot, actually, and there was one person killed in another spot down the coast in a later attack during the night.
So who has been apprehended, Fiona, so far?
We had 5 terrorists were shot after this second attack in a town called Cambrils, which is a coastal town just down the coast. So those 5 terrorists were shot and killed by police at the scene. They were unable to travel very far in their car, although they injured 7 people, and one of those people have died since of their injuries. There's 3 other people who have been arrested by police in the last 14 hours, but importantly, the person who is presumed to be the driver of that van that carried out that first attack in Barcelona is still on the run. Now, police have released details about him. His name is Moussa Ouikib, and he is originally from Morocco, although he's had Spanish residency since 1990. And he's around 18 years old. And he is his brother's in custody, but police are searching for him. And they're also searching for 3 other people that they think were part of the cell that planned and orchestrated these attacks.
So ISIS has claimed responsibility for this attack in Barcelona. Fiona, there have been similar car attacks elsewhere in Europe, France, of course, Nice and Paris, in the UK. Did Barcelona, Spain more broadly, consider itself a target?
Well, Spain has been on terrorist alert level 4 for the last 2 years. That's 4 out of a possible 5. And that means that the security forces have been very vigilant against attacks, although they haven't had any specific intelligence for targeted zones, which means that they weren't suspecting of an imminent attack in that named place. In the last few months, we've seen a big increase in armed police on the streets, at tourist areas, and in areas like airports, train stations, and when there's fiestas going on. They have introduced measures like bollards on pedestrian streets to try and stop potential terrorists using vehicles, which seems to be the latest weapon of choice by such groups. Within seconds of that van mounting the pavement, police were there. So I think that's why it was avoided that there could have been so many more people hurt and killed.
And of course, Spain was a target of a major attack in 2004 on the train system outside of Madrid. So Spain has, unfortunately, some deep experience with terrorism, and it sounds like the country was prepared, but not necessarily prepared for this.
Well, that terrorist attack in 2004 is very, very prevalent in the psyche of the Spanish people. They haven't forgotten about that attack, and really it's been a sort of case of hoping for the best in recent times. You know, Spain has watched attacks in London, in Berlin, in Paris, in Nice, and really thought this could happen in Spain. It really could, and of course the caliphate history of Spain with its Muslim past has made Spain more of a target in a way than some of the other places. So it doesn't come as a great surprise that an attack took place here, although, of course, it's deeply shocking that it occurred and people are still terribly upset about it, terribly shocked and terribly upset.
Fiona Govan with The Local in Spain, thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
It's The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Black athletes like LeBron James spoke out on social media after the violence in Charlottesville over the weekend and President Trump's refusal to isolate white nationalist demonstrators. Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation magazine and host of the Edge of Sports podcast, says black athletes tend to shoulder the burden of standing up against racism and that it's time for white athletes to join them.
I think what we need to see in the 21st century, and I have to be clear, you're seeing this far more with women athletes in the WNBA than you're seeing this with men athletes, is black and white athletes together saying there is a problem when it comes to racism. There is a problem when it comes to police violence. And we want to use our Hyper Exalted, brought to you by Nike platforms, to say something about it.
You mentioned a couple of athletes in a recent article, including Sean Doolittle, who went to the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. He's a closer for my Washington Nationals. What has Sean Doolittle been saying, and why does that matter?
He is saying quite explicitly that Nazis have no place in American life, which tragically now puts you at odds with the president of the United States, which therefore, almost by definition, makes it a rebellious statement. And he's also saying that black and white athletes need to step up and say that this is no longer acceptable. And he calls out toxic whiteness by its name. And so this is a which side are you on question. It's not white versus black. It's justice versus injustice. It's Nazi versus anti-Nazi. That's the message that Sean has been pushing. And again, I have to say there's something inherently rebellious about statements that even a week ago would have seemed very milquetoast. Because a week ago, maybe we would have said, oh, you're anti-Nazis? Oh, that's great. Are you anti-cockroaches too? I mean, it doesn't seem like the most controversial thing to say. But when you are saying these things in the face of an online army of people you know are going to harass you, and in the face of a president who seems to be giving them support, then it becomes a situation far more polarizing and far more courageous. It's always easier to say nothing. These athletes are choosing a different path.
So, Dave, beyond sharing the burden of speaking out at a time of crisis, what would be the broader impact, in your view, if more white athletes joined the fray here?
Well, that's a terrific question. I had this exact discussion with Michael Bennett, and in addition to it lessening that burden on the black athlete to always have to carry that upon their shoulders, there is also the issue of how we are going to spread these conversations among sports fans, more specifically white sports fans. And to have white athletes speak out against racism, what it does is it opens up new avenues for conversations in new places that would otherwise not exist. I mean, can you imagine for a second what would happen? Not that this athlete would ever do that, but can you imagine if Tom Brady filmed a YouTube video of him burning a swastika? And the conversation that would provoke. It would be a very different kind of discussion than if Michael Bennett did something similar.
I imagine, Dave Zirin, that a lot of the men carrying torches in Charlottesville on Friday night and chanting anti-Jewish slogans are probably huge sports fans. What do you think would go on in their minds if some of their favorite white athletes told them to get lost?
I think it would make them feel more isolated, which I believe is the only way they're ever going to be defeated. I think we do it by them feeling that there is no oxygen for their hate. And sports is a huge source of cultural oxygen in this country. And for them to see their heroes tell them to go to hell would have, I think, a tremendous effect on their own confidence, which right now, thanks to the White House, is at an all-time high. They need to be demoralized, and white athletes play a critical role in making that happen.
Dave Zirin is sports editor for The Nation magazine. He's host of the Edge of Sports podcast. Dave, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Guys, I'm eating junk and watching rubbish.
Let me try that cheesecake.
Is that ice cream?
That's a shake. That's milk and ice cream.
Take a cookie.
Sir, jelly donut, sir.
A jelly donut?
They got a baby Ruth.
Leave the gun. Take the cannoli.
Who had coconut?
Life was like a box of chocolates.
Your wife's cookies are out of this world.
The snozzberries taste like snozzberries.
Snozzberries? Who ever heard of a snozzberry?
It's dessert day for Movie Time on Fridays here on The Takeaway. Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, and The Takeaway is with me. Hi, Rafer.
Hey, Todd.
Sounds delicious, doesn't it?
It sure does.
We got two movies today. Lucky Logan is starring Channing Tatum and Adam Driver. These are brothers, right, attempting to a heist during a NASCAR race. Also, Patty Cakes, which is the story of a rapper in Blue Collar, New Jersey, which I saw the trailer for. Looked really, really interesting. Rafer, you're here, and that means trivia, of course.
Okay.
I got a little Channing Tatum trivia for you here. Now, hold your answer. We'll get back to it at the end. And if you know the answer, guys, hit me up on Twitter if you think you know it. We'll try to get one of you on the air here if you know the answer. So Channing Tatum, as I mentioned, stars in Lucky Logan along with Daniel Craig and Adam Driver, Rafer. Here's Channing Tatum singing and tapping in 2016.
We are heading out to sea. And however it'll be, It ain't gonna be the same.
Your question with Channing Tatum there is Name That Film 2016. Hold your answer. Folks, if you know it, you can hit me on Twitter. Now, Lucky Logan is directed by Steven Soderbergh. Channing Tatum's in that. Of course, I mentioned Daniel Craig. Here's a clip.
Before I take on any job, I look at it the same way as it takes to make the thing. Positive versus negative. Now, you mix a little bit of this with a little bit of that, and you get a reaction. A reaction is power, and it's moving fast, and it's moving away from you, and it keeps moving till it hits something.
Getting ready for their heist on the NASCAR track there, Raper.
That's right, and that's Daniel Craig. You wouldn't know it by listening to him, but
that's
James Bond himself playing the safecracker named Joe Bang, explaining how he's going to blow up this vault. This is basically sort of a backwoods Ocean's 11 from Steven Soderbergh. I don't think he's making any real bones about that. It has the same kind of feel. You know, nothing ever really bad happens. It's just a lot of fun. It's just fun to watch the characters interact. Adam Driver is great as one-armed bartender, Channing Tatum, a lot of fun. Again, Daniel Craig, who gets an and introducing credit in the film. It's just a good, breezy heist flick with a great script, possibly written under a pseudonym by Steven Soderbergh, but a very good action comedy.
A really summer movie.
Yeah, very summer movie.
Okay, that's Lucky Logan with Channing Tatum, Daniel Craig, who sounds curiously Southern there, British Daniel Craig. Patty Cake, let's listen to a clip about a rapper in New Jersey.
It's gonna be an Indian summer, y'all. Mr. Jerry Curls, a.k.a. Young Stables, a.k.a. Deepak Shakur, a.k.a. the Durag Da Vinci, a.k.a. Raw Dog Zillionaire, a.k.a. the Quiet Storm, boys and girls. I give you my soulmate, my homie-o. It's Jeromeo!
This isn't Showtime at the Apollo, okay? We have customers here. Play make-believe on your lunch break.
That's Patty Cake, so I guess is a waitress trying to be a rapper.
Well, she's in a pharmacist in that particular scene. But yeah, that's Daniel McDonald, unknown Australian actress playing Patty Cakes, a white plus-size New Jersey rapper trying to make it in the music industry. Very interesting film from a guy who comes from New Jersey, first-time director, big hit at Sundance. Gritty, raw, authentic, some dodgy acting, but a good film with a lot of heart and a lot of charm.
I thought the trailer was interesting. I'm probably going to see that one. I thought it was a good take. I was thinking of 8 Mile when I saw it. That's not necessarily fair.
Very much so.
Yeah, but I thought it was interesting. All right, now, Rafer, I played you a clip of Channing Tatum tapping and singing in 2016.
We are heading out to sea, and however it'll be, it ain't gonna be the same.
Rafer, name that film.
I'm pretty sure that's Hail Caesar.
That is Hail Caesar.
All
congratulations,
right.
Rafer Guzman from the Coen Brothers. That's right, 2016. Great Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday and for us here at The Takeaway. Have a great weekend.
You too, Todd.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick. The 1.3 million Rohingya Muslims in Myanmar have been facing entrenched persecution from the military for decades. Even when Burma began to democratize in 2011 and became Myanmar, that persecution persisted. Tun Kin is president of the Burmese Rohingya Organization UK. He was forced to flee his home in Myanmar 18 years ago. He recently traveled to Bangladesh to bear witness to a growing wave of displaced Rohingya refugees from Myanmar. Along with Tun Kin was Dan Sullivan, senior advocate for human rights at Refugees International. Tun Kin is one of the roughly 500,000 displaced Burmese Rohingya Muslims caught up in this growing humanitarian crisis and forced to flee from their homes.
What Rohingyas are facing is a man-made tragedy, is a religious, political, and ethnic persecution we are facing. Rohingyas are the largest Muslim minority in our Kano state, and Rohingyas are, you know, different from other ethnic group of Burma. Their appearance is South Asian appearance, and it's a hatred and a kind of being Muslim. This is one of the bottom line, I should say.
Dan Sullivan at Refugees International, trace for us the history of the persecution that Tun Kin is describing in Myanmar. How far back does this go, and did it start to change at all when Burma liberalized a bit and became Myanmar.
Yeah, it goes back several decades. The military-led government has, for many years, denied basic rights of the Rohingya. You know, one of the kind of tragedies is in recent years where there has been a movement towards democratic reforms, including Aung San Suu Kyi, formerly under house arrest, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, becoming the effective leader of the country. Even as some of those reforms have come along, things have gotten decidedly worse for the Rohingya in the country.
But Dan, if there's been this liberalization and some democratization in Myanmar under Aung San Suu Kyi, which there has been, has her government been unable to dial back on some of this persecution from the military? Are they unwilling or do they just not want to?
Yeah, I think it's important to remember that the military maintains a lot of influence in the country. It's been members of the military, the security forces, that have been the main perpetrators of the abuses. That said, Aung San Suu Kyi and her government have not only spoken out against those abuses, they've actually defended the military and refused to allow international observers to go in, to allow international humanitarian aid to go in. And Aung San Suu Kyi's government continues to refuse to provide them access.
Tunkin, there are an estimated 500,000 Rohingya refugees living in Bangladesh. And you went on a trip there recently, not only to Bangladesh, but you got very close, even just a few hundred meters, it seems, across the water there to your native Myanmar. What did you see when you were in Bangladesh?
It's quite worrying that they are living a kind of, you know, a squalid condition where they don't have proper shelter, they are not getting enough food, and their future is quite blind. The thing is, unfortunately, the other side where their house has been burned down, where their sisters and their wives been raped by military, and when they crossed the border, they were not welcome. And, you know, it's been going on many decades. Rohingya refugees been fleeing from the country.
Dan, what's the end game for the government in Myanmar? Would they like to see all of the remaining Rohingya population pushed across the water and across the border into Burma?
Yeah, they haven't said so much as that's their plan, but all of the actions by the military and some of the various comments that have been made do suggest that there is a desire to get rid of this problem of the Rohingya, and they refuse to recognize the Rohingya as a people. So they're not even allowing the Rohingya to self-identify. There was a UN report out last year that said there were very likely crimes against humanity, and then, you know, several reports that ethnic cleansing is happening. So, you know, which it seems like the end game is to either get them to flee out of the country or to renounce their own self-identification.
Well, Dan Tunkin is president of Burmese Rohingya Organization UK, as I mentioned before. What's been the response from the international community of late to put pressure on the government in Myanmar? Have the Brits, have the Europeans, have the Americans stepped up with any of their ability to put substantial pressure on Burma?
There's a lot more that can be done by the international community. And, you know, one of the things that is troubling is waiting to see what the current U.S. administration under President Trump, what their policy will be towards Myanmar. And it's just really important that any kind of U.S.-Myanmar bilateral relations, that they prioritize the human rights situation, that ensure that there is accountability for the abuses that have happened against the Rohingya, starting with the access for the U.N. fact-finding mission, and that there's access for humanitarian aid. And then, you know, in the long term, that there is a path to citizenship for the Rohingya and addressing the root causes there.
Tunkin, you hear Dan Sullivan talking about the Americans in neighboring countries. What do you want to see immediately from the Brits or the Americans or the Europeans here?
So Aung San Suu Kyi is supported by many years from international community like EU, US and UK. It is time for US, UK, EU, UN and others, you know, to put a stronger pressure that to allow humanitarian aid access. And secondly, if UN fact-finding mission must allow. So this is international community collectively must put pressure to NLD government and militaries to stop current atrocities against Rohingya and to allow this fact-finding mission.
Tunkin, before I let you and Dan go, I saw a photograph of you recently in Bangladesh, looking across the water to your homeland of Myanmar, not very far away. a couple of hundred meters. What were you thinking when you were looking across there?
Oh, it's quite emotional when I was there because, you know, it's like just 25 minutes by boat to my native land. You know, our grandfathers and fathers, they were contributed a lot to the development of Burma. We are a part of Burmese society, but unfortunately, like me, 1.3 million Rohingyas are facing these serious human rights violations. Enough is enough.
Thunkin is president of the Burmese Rohingya Organization UK. Thunkin, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And Dan Sullivan, senior advocate for human rights at Refugee International. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
It's been 99 years since the sun last went out in the continental United States, and 26 years since the last solar eclipse darkened Hawaii in 1991. But on Monday, August 21st, the glorious totality returns, slashing through the country from Oregon to South Carolina. Millions of people will be staring skyward as the sun goes dark on Monday, including many of you.
This is Martha from St. Louis.
This is Nate Surrey from Westfield, New Jersey.
Hi, this is Robert in Miami.
This is Jenna Lawson from Portland, Oregon.
Hi, my name's Parker. I'm from Salt Lake City, Utah. I'm a sixth grade teacher. We will be taking our students out right before lunch, as the totality will be about 90% then.
I'll be traveling from Rhode Island, Greenville, South Carolina. It's about 900 miles just to see the eclipse.
We're in the zone of totality, and my kids are off school that day. We plan to experience the eclipse straight from the front yard, quite simply.
You guys are excited for this. Of course, it wasn't always so. Eclipses are fun and predictable now, but for most of history, they were harbingers of doom. But solar eclipses have also provided key moments for scientific advancement for humans. John Dvorak is author of Mask of the Sun, The Science, History, and Forgotten Lore of Eclipses. According to John, humans have been trying to understand the solar eclipse for as long as the moon has been passing between them and the sun.
There was a real need to try and predict these things. All cultures are interested in watching the motion of the sun and the moon. Most, if not all cultures, are interested in trying to predict where these things are going to be. And that means that they have a great interest in trying to predict not only the passing of the seasons, but even when there's going to be an eclipse. Because if something up in the sky seems to be going wrong, people start wondering about the rulers and so forth. And the rulers are worried about, is there something which they're supposed to do? Is there a ritual I'm supposed to do?
The rulers start worrying about their own well-being. I mean, you write about that even in the Catholic Church, which we sort of associate with the rejection of magic and astrology. Popes in the 1500s were terrified of eclipses, thinking it spelled doom for their own lives.
Oh, yes, that's true. As we get back to the 17th century and earlier, astrology was part of your life. And of course, in the church, watching the sun and the moon was very important. It was a direct connection right there. And in the history of the Catholic Church, this whole thing about magic, sorcery, and of astrology was commonplace. But an eclipse changed all of that.
You write about something that you call Einstein's error, the most important eclipse in history. Talk about that.
The most important total solar eclipse happened in May 1919. Let's step back. 1919, we'll go back 4 years, 1915. Einstein has just released his general theory of relativity. And as a result of that, he says the space-time concept, space is actually curved. And he makes this outrageous forecast, this outrageous prediction that starlight, when it passes a massive object, does not go in a straight line, but it actually curves. When starlight passes near a massive object like the sun, it will actually bend a bit. And he actually made a way to check this. He said, if you look during a total solar eclipse, when the sky is dark and you can see stars, the position of those stars will be a little different than during times when there wasn't a sun nearby. And that would be the effect of the deflection of starlight. Well, 1919 total solar eclipse, it was confirmed, and literally overnight, Einstein becomes a worldwide celebrity. The second big impact is that it completely changed our idea of scientific truth. And that comes from a philosopher of science. He was Karl Popper. He was very young at the time, and he heard Einstein give a lecture in Vienna. And he was working on this problem in philosophy of science. How do you tell the difference between science and non-science? He labeled it the demarcation problem. And because of Einstein and the eclipse and showing the bending of starlight, Popper said, I've got it. Most people say science is about confirming theories. And he said, no, it's real easy to go out, make a measurement, and confirm theories. He says the difficult part is to come up with an idea that might falsify. So his idea was falsifiability. The way, according to Popper, that you can tell science from non-science, if you can come up with an experiment that could falsify a theory, that is science. If you cannot, that should not be considered science.
And an important thing to remember about the danger of unfalsifiable theories and what they really represent.
Well, that's right. And that's when, in the modern world, when we get into discussions of astrology, intelligent design, creationism and such, the scientific world will say those cannot be falsified. What you can't do is an experiment to reject any of those statements. Whereas in physics and astronomy and biology, the really key is the scientific theory falsifiable. And of course, the corollary to that that comes from Popper is that science is not definitive. There is no absolute truth in science.
So for you, John Dvorak, when you watch modern debates on intelligent design or something similar, for you, this goes back to 1919. This goes back to a total eclipse of the sun.
The whole roots with falsifiability and separating science from non-science, it's this inspiration that Popper got from Einstein and this total solar eclipse, May 1919.
Well, I won't call the eclipse experience religious because I'm not sure you would like that, but it's certainly maybe transcendent, John Dvorak. How many eclipses have you seen?
I've only seen two total solar eclipses, but both of them were spectacular. Even though I understand what's happening and I know what's going to take place, you still get this unsettling feeling inside. And I sort of describe it that when the sun goes out suddenly, it's that most primitive part of the brain we have, you know, the part which we share with the reptiles, that kicks in because so many unusual things are going on around you. And one of the very most basic things that I expect to be out there is the sun, and the sun just goes away.
Well, John Dvorak, you know, on the one hand, this eclipse we have on our hands is the most unremarkable, most predictable of all the celestial events. You know when it's going to happen, you know why and where. Like you said, when the sun goes out, it's far from a banal experience.
I've been waiting for this since I was 12 years old. I was in a library, I opened a book of astronomy, and I saw this eclipse path, and I was wondering, was I actually going to live long enough to see that? That was over 50 years ago.
Well, your moment is just about here, John Dvorak, and it is for all of us. And your book is out right on time, of course, Mask of the Sun, The Science, History, and Forgotten Lore of Eclipses. John Dvorak, thank you.
Well, thank you.
I'm spending the week next week in St. Louis with my two sisters and my 93-year-old mother. We've been planning this eclipse trip for the past 2 years.
I'm going to take a look at that eclipse. It'll probably be the last one for me.
I'm so excited.
Oh, we've heard from so many of you, young and old, excited for that eclipse. Have fun out there. Don't forget to protect your eyes. Get the right kind of certified glasses. They look like, old movie 3D glasses. We've got them for our trip already. One of my friends has collected a whole stack, and I'm going to be out there on Monday, too. Tell us all about it on Monday at 8778MyTake. You can always send your tweets from the moon shadow at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. Have a great weekend, everybody. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Arkansas Economic Development Commission and the state devoted to entrepreneurship and innovation. Learn more about the benefits of growing a startup or scale-up business in Arkansas at arkansasedc.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.